Roll them.
Tell me all you know about the arboretum.
Okay. Yeah, the remarkable thing about the University of Wisconsin Arboretum is that it's the site of some of the really classic work on ecological restoration. Hard to believe now, 55, 60 years later, but back in the 1930s, the idea of going into a place that had been a landscape that had been altered by human activities in a dramatic way, and making a deliberate, systematic attempt to reverse time, turn the clock back, really, to bring that back into its former condition, was in many respects a novel idea. And that idea was expressed more clearly and carried out more systematically at the Arboretum here at the University of Wisconsin than apparently anywhere else in the world. So that the Arboretum is really kind of the Kitty Hawk of the business and the discipline, the science and the art of ecological restoration. That's a big deal. That's ecosystem medicine, and the technology of immense importance for the conservation of the natural classical ecosystems, and just as important in my view as a way of establishing a relationship with those systems, a relationship between ourselves and the natural world. The University of Wisconsin Arboretum has a kind of long prehistory, really, and very interestingly, it goes back to the early decade of this century, the first decade or two of this century, especially the teens, I suppose, when a group of interested citizens here in the city, called the Madison Park and Pleasure Drive Association, were attempting to, they made it their business to get a hold of property. I suppose it was mostly old farmland at the time, and on the edge of the city, and acquire it and develop it as parkland. Eventually, their plan was to turn it over to the city. They were quite successful, and many of the finest parks, especially in the area around what was at that time the edge of the city, were Vilas Park, Tenney Park, later Olbrich Park, were acquired by these people, and something we owe them. Well, during the 20s, one of the more energetic leaders of this group, Michael Olbrich, turned his attention to the property south of Lake Wingra, which at that time was a patchwork of farms of marginal agricultural value, and to some extent had been protected by development, I think, by the lake itself, by Lake Wingra, and the extensive lowlands that surrounded that lake, especially to the east, so that the big wetland, which we now call Gardner Marsh, kind of had kept the city away from those uplands south of the lake. And although development had begun in the Nakoma area, and Paul Stark and the realtors were buying and developing that land, the land just south and west of the lake, which is now the Arboretum, was still being farmed. And Olbrich thought this would make a fine park. And so that was the first stirring of an idea that land should be set aside as open space, but not as an arboretum, you notice. Olbrich's idea was another park. This would have been a huge park. It would have, in effect, extended Vilas Park all the way around the lake, from the east end of the lake, where Vilas is now, all the way around the lake to, to the Nakoma development, the area which is now the Arboretum. Olbrich, although he had been, Olbrich was a civic leader in many respects. He was an attorney. He was a member of the Board of Regents. pretty well respected in the community. He'd been successful as a leader of this effort. Old Brick Park is named after him in recognition of this, but he was not successful in getting this this really ambitious scheme off the ground. I understand that he simply couldn't get the support he needed to do it. So sometime along in the mid-1920s, someone came to him, and we believe it might have been Paul Stark.
Was this Paul Stark, the
realtor?
The
realtor, the father of the present, I guess it's the father of the present sons who are running the Stark Realty, yeah. Suggested, well, came to, they were friends, and he came to Ulbrich and said, Mike, this isn't getting off the ground. Here's an idea for you. Why don't you, the university has been interested in establishing an arboretum for quite a number of years. The plan originally, or going way back, well, at least to John Nolan's time, about 1908, had been to establish an arboretum for the university just west of the campus, out around University Bay. But they hadn't done that either. So Stark said, let's have an arboretum out here on Lake Wingra. Repackage this idea, in other words. Get a fancier label on it. The people apparently think they have enough parks. So let's sell them a laboratory and a classroom for the university, or let's sell this to the Regents. And that may give us, with a slightly different label, the same result. That is, an extensive open space protected from development and with at least a certain amount of public access for recreation. Ulbrich apparently thought that was a good idea, and he began trying to carry that out. In 1927, I think it was, he got the approval of the Regents to accept this land if somebody would give it to them as an arboretum. But he still couldn't get the money. But shortly after that, of course, the country was getting into the Depression. Ulbrich committed suicide about that time, I think shortly after the crash on Wall Street. I think that was linked to that. He had extensive investments. And the project languished for several years during the beginning of the Depression. However, very interestingly, now as we look back, it's clear that it was precisely the Depression and the great ecological disaster of the time, the Dust Bowl, especially the Dust Bowl, that really created the conditions which made it possible to bring the Arboretum into being, and that the Arboretum is a creation of the 1930s. It was a 1930s event. Ulbrich couldn't have foreseen that in 1929, but it turned out to be true. What happened was the Depression brought land prices down to unbelievably low levels, making it possible, creating a window, actually, so that so that it was possible to acquire this land, which would have been difficult or impossible to do on a large scale at any other time in the past century. The prices that were eventually paid for this land are laughably low, even if you multiply by 10 or 15 to account for the difference in inflation since the 1930s, which is, I don't know what the factor would be, but it would be probably at least an order of magnitude. At one point, we acquired nearly 200 acres of land, lowland, east of Lake Wingra, for something in the neighborhood of $15,000. As late as 1941, we acquired the Grady Tract south of the Beltline, 230 acres, for $13,500. And that was essentially all upland. Now, you can go ahead and multiply that by 10, and you still haven't got a good tract house in today's dollars. So the acquisition of land for the Arboretum coincided almost exactly with these years of depression. And major acquisition came not quite to an end, but was virtually complete by 1941, when, of course, the Depression was getting over and we were getting into World War II. So by 1941, the Arboretum had assumed its present outlines, give or take 100 acres, and had reached about 1,100 acres. Now it's 1,280, and looked on a map pretty much the way it does now. And this was clearly because the farmers were going out of business and were unable to hang on to their land. The price was... nobody could afford to buy it, and with the help of a few public-spirited citizens who became committed to this idea, it was possible to get together those sums of money to buy this land, and virtually all of it was purchased with gifts. At this point, the spark plug was Colonel Joe Jackson, who had been inspired by this idea of creating this open space around Lake Wingra. Oh, I don't know whether he heard Ulbricht talk about it or whether Leopold was mixed up in that in some way, but somewhere how by about 1931 or two, Joe Jackson had come into this idea and assumed leadership at a time when nobody else had assumed leadership. And Jackson made it his business to go around and squeeze all of his well-to-do friends for money. And he, one of his close friends was Louis Gardner, who at that time owned, for many years, owned the Gardner Bakery, and had some money and enough public interest to make sizable donations to the Arboretum at crucial moments during this land acquisition process. Jackson was the guy who made all this happen back there in the 30s, who got the money, acquired the land, got the money and made it possible to acquire all that land. So we owe him that. And that was, as I said, very much a part of the Depression, a reflection of the economic conditions of those times. But we owe something else to the 30s, and that was the idea behind the Arboretum. The question, what are we going to do with this property? Now, the original idea, as I told you, was there was an ambivalence here. There was the people who were really responsible for bringing this into reality at this point were people whose fundamental interest in the property was as an amenity open space. But in the process of getting the job done, they had turned it over to the university. And the university had put it in the hands of a committee, the Arboretum Committee, with the understanding that it was to be developed as an outdoor teaching and research facility. Now, these things are not exactly the same. Are you going to build a lot of picnic shelters and have picnic tables and dog walking? Or are you going to have experimental plots and, you know, so forth? And can these things be compatible? So this has been something of an issue throughout the history of the Arboretum. And this, I think, is true of many institutions of this kind. You usually have some kind of mixture of motives and purposes, and they live more or less comfortably together. But in any case, the first land was acquired for the Arboretum in 1932. By 1934, the property had grown to about 500 acres, right about in what's now the center of the Arboretum, the uplands centering on Charlie Nelson's farm, where the McKay Center stands now, actually on the site of Nelson's barn, which burned down in March of 1937. But there was the question of what to do with it. Now, it had been identified as an arboretum and wildlife refuge, and that might have, if one looked at well, again, those two ideas are different. Those are two different ideas. so there was some unclarity, some lack of clarity there. And I'm sure there were many ideas as there were people interested in the project as to how this land should be should be handled. But what became the real keynote for the development of the Arboretum was sounded by, at the dedication address. What became the keynote for the development of the Arboretum and the kind of basis for its blueprint, its development ever since, was sounded by Aldo Leopold in his address at the dedication in 1934, right in the middle of a hot summer, June 17th, 1934, with a major dust storm in recent memory. I mean, a big dust storm had come through Madison just 5 weeks earlier in the middle of May. Leopold stood up and gave a nice little speech. We still have a copy of it, in which he, you know, you could read from, you could excerpt that, you could excerpt that speech. Oh, you do? Yeah, right, okay. He got up and he reminded people how much the landscape had changed. It had at that point been just short of a century since Yankee settlement of the Madison area. And Leopold evoked that pre-settlement past with the vast prairies intermixed with oak savannas and extensive wetlands around the lake, such as Lake Wingra, forests in wind shadows, downwind from hills and lakes and rivers and so forth, a diverse landscape characteristic of the prairie forest border, the two big ecosystems, biomes that come together here in the upper Midwest. And having evoked that, he reminded people how much it had changed and how, as he said, you probably couldn't recognize the place if you were brought back 100 years on this same little hill where Charlie Nelson's barn now stands. You probably wouldn't recognize the place. And then he went on to suggest, he said, what we plan to do with this property is something new and different. And what we're going to do is try to bring it back into its pre-settlement condition. Simple as that. Really, his idea, if you take it apart a little bit, had two novel elements. The first was the very idea of creating a collection of what? Of ecosystems was a real departure from any kind of tradition, really. It borrows from certain traditions in landscape architecture and wildlife management and so forth that go back, forest management, that go back even centuries. But in certain respects, It was unique in its clarity of the clarity of its the clarity with which he expressed the idea of reconstructing a historic landscape. Let me go back a little bit here. What I'm trying to say is that there were two novel things about Leopold's, about the idea that Leopold formulated. This probably wasn't Leopold's idea all by himself. We know it wasn't. Others contributed to it. There was Norman Fassett, for example, and Bill Longenecker got involved very soon, as did John Curtis, and all of these people contributed to it. It does seem, however, that Leopold was the first person. He was chosen, for some reason, to be the first to articulate this formally and publicly at the dedication. The idea of creating a collection of ecosystems was somewhat novel in itself. Institutions such as arboreta and botanical gardens, and zoos for that matter, had traditionally collected species of plants or animals and not whole ecosystems. So what this reflected was Leopold's own and that of his colleagues, the growing awareness of ecology, really, as a discipline, and of ecosystems or ecological communities as entities with sort of academic status, you might say, something that deserved to be studied and that had value as entities. I think this commitment to create a collection of these entities is an expression of that growing awareness, which of course is part of the history of ecology in the United States at that time. Secondly, the most interesting aspect of this was that in order to to create this collection, especially on this degraded, or let's say altered, especially on this altered landscape, it would be necessary to reconstruct many of them. So the plan to create the collection, which seems to have been foremost in everyone's mind, implied an attempt to reconstruct many of them. Those in particular which had existed on the site at the time of settlement, but which either no longer existed or had been reduced to next to nothing, which was especially the case with the tall grass prairies. So the plan implied restoration on a substantial scale, and Leopold said as much. And he said, we're going to try to put this all back together again. He said it'll take a long time. We don't know how to do it. It might take as much as 50 years, but we're going to get started. Whether this is a good idea, I leave you to judge, and I guess that's still up for discussion. But we certainly think it was a good idea. So there was a clear expression, a commitment to an expression of the idea, and a commitment to reduce that idea to practice, kind of like an invention, to reduce the idea of restoration to practice on a significant scale. At that point, as I said, the Arboretum included about 500 acres, and restoration projects undertaken during the 1930s eventually extended through, and I'm just guessing here, maybe 250 acres of land came under some degree of restoration. Now, right from the beginning, it was the prairies that moved into the foreground of consideration here. And before I get into that, I want to point out that here we have another 30s event. The creation, the development of this idea clearly reflected conservation concerns of the time and the reaction of conservationists to ecological disasters such as the Dust Bowl. That being probably the most conspicuous and acute ecological problem of the time, but also deforestation in the north. In a sense, Madison sits in a ecologically sat at that time in an ecologically privileged isthmus between two major disaster areas. The deforestation to the north was essentially complete by the 1930s. And of course the Dust Bowl to the south and west had demanded national and international attention as a major human-caused ecological catastrophe. So a conservation movement came out of that concern, especially during the administration of Franklin Roosevelt. Leopold was one of the leaders of that conservation movement, and it was a movement that was very much concerned with reclamation of degraded land. Its characteristic activities were tree planting by the Civilian Conservation Corps and revegetation of grasslands out west. The Arboretum clearly is part of that larger national movement, the conservation movement. It shared its concern, its commitment to rehabilitation of degraded landscapes. It was different, however. It was set apart. It was distinct, however, because of its explicit commitment not just to rehabilitation in some general sense, or reclamation, rather general terms, but to the literal restoration of the historic system. The attempt to create a copy, the way you would do with an old car or a Stradivari violin, something of that kind, which has been sadly neglected or damaged in some way, but which you value, and therefore you try to bring it back. This was what distinguished the Arboretum from this more general kind of commitment to restoration. And to come back where I was, it was the prairies that very rapidly moved into the foreground of the effort, and one has to assume the consciousness of the people involved.
How did they know that this had been a prairie, and what kind of prairie grass?
Yeah, good question. The process of restoration begins really with an attempt to discover something about the original ecosystem that you're going to try to restore. A primary source of that information in the Midwest turns out to be surveyors' records. And actually it was partly as a result of the efforts to do this restoration work at the Arboretum that people started looking. Well, let me rephrase that. In the 30s and 40s, when Leopold and his colleagues began working on this restoration project, they started looking at surveyors' records to get this information. In the years since, this information has been extensively compiled and summarized into beautiful maps and so forth, but those didn't exist at that time. And I'm not sure in the early stages of this process how systematic that was. In fact, well, maybe we won't get into that. That's getting kind of complicated. We do know, well, I don't know what they knew as opposed to what we knew. They knew that prairie had been widespread in the Midwest at the time of settlement, of course, everyone would know that. They knew that although Wisconsin was on the edge of the prairie region, that prairie did extend into southern Wisconsin, and that there were sizable open grassland prairies scattered around southern Wisconsin at the time of settlement a century earlier. And on the strength of that knowledge, they set about restoring a fairly good-sized patch of prairie at the Arboretum in about 1934 and 5. The first steps in this work were undertaken even before the CCC camp opened there by John Thompson, who later was a student here at the university at that time and later became a professor in the botany department, only recently retired. You have him on tape, of course. John, as a young graduate student, did some of the first tinkering with the site to see what they could do to get the prairie vegetation back. I should say a little bit about the site that was selected for prairie restoration. It was at the time partly pasture, partly cornfield, partly hay field, which had been less severely disrupted, and in fact in one little corner down at the eastern end of Curtis Prairie, there was a little bit of kind of low area there which had not been plowed and where quite a number of prairie plants still existed. So there was a little bit of a starting place there for the prairie, but by far the large part of this 60-acre part of the property that had been set aside for prairie restoration was the prairie vegetation had been obliterated, and the site was occupied by pasture and old field vegetation where they'd been growing row crops and I suppose quack grass. And yeah, I don't know the details of that, but there was essentially no prairie vegetation left on most of the site. So of course, there were two things one had to do to start. One had to get seed and plants, just like any other kind of garden, and then one had to have a model somewhere. And so, beginning with John Thompson, who was a student of Norman Fassett's, Fassett said, "John, go out in the Driftless area. I think it mostly was west of Madison. There's little relic prairies there. Go out there. Let's start collecting seed. Let's try some different approaches to bringing the prairie back." They tried seed right off the bat. They tried some of the standard methods which have since which are still used, bringing back seed, bringing back freshly cut hay or dried plants and just scattering that around it. That of course would have lots of seed heads in it and so forth, and then later bringing back whole plants, putting seed in directly, putting seed in through a nursery, and then setting out small plants. All of these things were tried at one time or another, and those first few experiments were carried out by Thompson, I think probably in the summer of 1934. In 1935, the CCC camp opened there at the Arboretum, and the project from that point on was carried out in a more systematic way by detachment of CCC boys from Camp 2760. I think it was Camp 2760 of the Civilian Conservation Corps. But the prairie was preeminent. It still is in a way, and there's a number of reasons for it. In fact, one can list about 10 different reasons, but I think the most important was, especially in those early stages, that the prairie was the endangered community of the Midwest. It was, well, the forest had been, everything had been changed, this is true, and the forests had been clear-cut pretty much, but the forests were coming back. They weren't necessarily going to be just the way they were before. Species composition was going to be different, and obviously the trees weren't going to be hundreds of years old for hundreds of years.